Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As it gets to the last fortnight of the retreat period, sometimes it's too easy to send our mind off to what's going to happen afterwards. And as you know, that these retreats, which we have, the range retreats, are the perfect time for practice. Even though there may be some busyness in your monasteries, nevertheless, this is the most peaceful time of the year. So it's going to get more sort of disturbing, more things to do afterwards. Understanding that, we just make sure that we make use of the time we have as best as possible. So we don't send our minds off into the future. As I keep telling the lay community, that this moment is where your future is made. So anyone who really is caring about their future, who wants to make a good future, should put more attention in the present moment where the future is actually generated. And by doing that, by looking after the present moment, we can do probably the very best for our future. So this shows like an attitude of mind which works not only at this time of the range retreat, but also it works at all times of the range retreat, whether you are sweeping, whether you are driving, whether you are meditating, whether you are walking, whatever you're doing. Being able just to look after and care for this moment, to put the mindfulness in this moment, to understand what's happening. And the most important thing about the present moment is to have the right attitude towards it. As I've often said, I think throughout this range retreat, this moment is a result of old karma. Here it is. And the only thing we can possibly do with this moment, the only place we can interfere is right now, and how we interfere in a positive way is by the attitude we have to this present moment. To make sure we accept it, we're kind to it, we let it be, that we don't allow ourselves to get into the wrong intentions of grabbing onto it and ill will or even violence. So we have kindness, gentleness, letting go as our main motto. And if we do that, we understand another thing which I've been telling people in the interviews. The mind is a forerunner of all things, as the Buddha said in the Dhammapada. So if we get our mind state in this moment correct, right, proper, in other words, letting go, peaceful and gentle, then we know whatever we're doing, whether we be doing some translating or doing some typing or receiving a telephone call, whatever we're doing, we know that we're doing the very best we can possibly do. So we don't worry just how much time we have or how much time there isn't. We've always got this present moment. We can always be calm, we can always be gentle, we can always be peaceful, which means we can always practice. Because sometimes we always think that practice must be sitting down. I, if most monks, really encourage people to meditate a lot on the cushion, to do lots and lots of sitting meditation so you can get these amazing jhanas. But it's not just what you do on the sitting cushion which makes you a successful meditator. I was saying even this afternoon to one of the interviewees that I still remember in the early days of when I was a monk in Thailand, just because of my nature, just being a I hope, anyway, my understanding of myself is a reasonably kind monk who really likes to help other people, likes to serve them. Maybe one of the reasons I have to travel so much, because just too kind. But because of that, in those early days of Wat Nanachat or Wat Bapong, when I was a young monk, I would volunteer to do services, and I would do many services for the other monks. And whereas some of the other monks would just leave and go to these quiet monasteries to meditate, or they'd once they got out of the monastery after their fifth raid, and never came back for 5-6 years. And as for me, I was always there, called upon to help out, to look after, to take over when the abbot was away or whatever. I was always very willing to help and to do service. And at that time, I always thought that these other monks who were off there in the forest, day after day after day, not doing any service. I thought, wow, those guys must have much better meditation than me. They must be the Arupa jhanas by now. And I was actually quite surprised that when we started talking and checking out what they were doing, I had the best meditation. And that really sort of surprised me. And why was it when I was doing all this service for other people, that when the time it was when I could just be by myself and do a little self-retreat, or just have the time during the range retreat where you could meditate more, why was it that my meditation was better? And you realize, you know, if the insights come up, it's not just the time which you spend on the cushion. It's the attitude which you bring to your meditation. And that attitude you bring to the meditation, you can see that in the attitude you bring to what's called to do. They always say in the forest tradition, you can tell a person's meditation by the way they sweep the paths. It's an old Thai forest tradition saying. And here you can say you can tell them how they do what their meditation is like by the way they arrange the breakfast things if they're on breakfast duty. You can tell how the meditation is going just by, you know, the way that they carry their bowls. Because the attitude you have to all these little things in life, this is the same attitude you'll have towards the meditation when you sit down. It's cultivating that right attitude which was the most important. So when I was doing service, I was cultivating the attitude of letting go, not really thinking of myself, no, not attaining things, I'll do that later on. My idea was actually to serve, which is like a let go of the sense of self, or what I need, what I'm going to get, what's in it for me. It's a strange being a Theravada monk, because we're supposed to be Hinayana and just in it for ourselves. But of course you've heard me explain, there's no such thing as that. It's not me, it's not the other, it's not this person watching the meditation object even. It's just us. Or rather, I like to put the attention in between this thing I call the observer and the observed. When you put it in there, it's nothing to do with the observer, with me. It's not what I want, it's not what I need, it's not what I'm going to try and get in the last 2 weeks of this retreat. If you think like that, you're putting getting and wanting and desire and craving, even craving for good things, you know, in between you and whatever you're doing, whether it's sweeping or whether it's watching nimittas. If you put a bit of craving in there, in that space, you're going to miss the whole path. So it's not about wanting, because that's all coming from the sense of self. Now, if there's no self in there, what do you need? What do you want? There's nothing to want. There's no one in there to want anything. It's completely empty. Just you're playing games. No wonder you don't get anywhere. Ajahn Chah's favorite similar, well, not favorite, one of his favorite ones, was people searching for the tortoise with a mustache. And how many of you are still searching for that tortoise with a mustache? You've been searching for many years. You can search for it in Korea, you can search for it in the United States, you can search for it in monasteries in the East, in Thailand. Always searching for the tortoise with a mustache. And have you ever got frustrated? And you're meditating, it's not working, you're practicing, you're not getting insights, and you're wondering, what's going on here? Have you ever thought that it's actually you're searching for the wrong thing, in the wrong place? We're searching for things. In other words, we're trying to attain things, to get things, to get more experiences. Not understanding the whole purpose of this path is for us to disappear. And with it, all of our belongings, all of our attainments, all little badges. I remember when, as a young boy, I joined the Scouts. I actually didn't even get to the Scouts, there was the one below that, the Cubs. And you used to sort of work so hard getting your badges. The badges for making a cup of tea. The badge for being able to make a fire. The badge for putting up a tent. And all these badges that somehow that's our society gets us into this idea of like getting attainments and runs on the board and certificates. And sometimes we bring that attitude that's very heavily conditioned into us, into monastic life. And so we all want a badge for first jhana. And I'll be awarding the badges at the Pawarana ceremony for those who've got first jhana and second jhana. Look, you don't do that. That's completely against the Dhamma. Because these aren't badges. These are actually tearing old badges off. Tearing all this idea of wanting and attaining and being and who you think you are. So it's taking those things off. All those supports for who you think you are, yourself, your ego, your being. The whole point of the practice here is to remove all those supports, which you know, you made a self from. You take those supports away one by one, the whole edifice of me, who I think I am, starts to fall apart. And of course that's scary, but look, there's no other choice. You know, it's got to go that way, you'll know that by now. So stop resisting it, just let it happen. Just let yourself vanish. You've all had enough understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. You'll know that non-self is just very clear, very plain. You know, no one in Theravada argues about that. They may argue about whether jhana is necessary or not, but no one argues about the fact there is nothing in here. Except maybe those chit-dharmas, but nothing actually in here, completely emptiness. Understanding that, just you can understand what the goal is. Understanding the goal makes it more clear what the path is. We know where you're going to head for, what your destination is. You can understand just whether you're closing in on that destination, but just by how much sense of self you've got left. So, coming close to the end of the retreat, period. What do you think of yourself? Do you think, oh, I've been really lazy. I just slept so much. I've talked so much. I've eaten so much. I feel terrible about myself. Now that's just as bad as a person saying, I got jhana this retreat. Whoopee. Yo-yo, I can't wait to tell everybody. In other words, you're not trying to sort of get attainments or get down on yourself if it didn't go so well. Your whole point is to let go of that whole attitude of judging yourself and measuring yourself by these things. Because when you don't judge and measure yourself by these things, you tend to disappear. But not only do you disappear, when your sense of self disappears, it gets impossible, almost impossible, to get upset and angry at other people. You know, you work in the kitchen, someone doesn't turn up, or someone asks for things they shouldn't ask for, or whatever, who are you getting angry at? It's just angry at a bunch of conditions. You're getting angry at five khandhas. It's not their fault. It's just they're going according to their own causes and conditions. You might as well get angry at a robot. I'm telling the robot or telling the rice cooker it's making too much noise. So hit it. And I can hit you again. I must admit that I do have watched comedy. And one of the comedy shows which I did watch was Fawlty Towers, because a mate from school was the, what was his name? Sorry, I can't remember so much. The waiter. Was it? Emmanuel, that's right, from Barcelona, but he was from Chiswick. But on one of those Fawlty Towers episodes, you had, who was it? John Cleese, whatever he's called, Basil Fawlty. His car had stopped when he was on an important mission to deliver a cake or something. And he sort of got a stick out and started beating his car, saying, this is not the first time. I warned you about this. As if like the car had a sort of a mind to actually, and decided to stop because it was wanton. And you see people, I remember once seeing a monk in Wat Nanachat, he was sewing and the needle kept on breaking, basically because he didn't know how to sew. And I remember him taking that sewing machine and banging it against the wall. You stupid sewing machine. It's not the sewing machine being stupid, it's just the sewing machine being a sewing machine. And even he wasn't stupid, he was just learning. It takes time to learn how to do these things. So why is it we get so frustrated and angry at life? Do we really think we can control it and manipulate it? If we beat the car, then it won't break down. If we bang the sewing machine enough time, it will learn its lesson and always do the right thing next time we use it. Now that's stupid, isn't it? You understand how stupid that is. But the wonderful thing about that little comedy sketch because it shows just how we sometimes abuse other people and we abuse ourselves with ill will and anger. We've just got the wrong attitude. Same with our meditation. We have this beautiful attitude of just watching and learning how to be kind and gentle and let go of things. Now, all the reason why people get restless in their meditation is, as I said last week, it's a reaction to sort of the unpleasantness of sensory experience. So you want to go off into fantasy worlds, into dream worlds, into planning, into doing things. And most of that, of doing and planning and sex and fantasies and dreams and whatever, is all about an escape from suffering. But after a while, one is mindful, reflective enough to say, that's not a very nice escape at all. It's a dead end. It's not the way to escape. There's another way to escape from the suffering of life. But that's to be so at peace with it, so still with it, not try and get rid of things, but to be with it. Because I said last week, when you're still, things start to disappear. Again, the mind is the forerunner of all things. So the mind has to be still first. It's a beautiful thing to understand. When you're still, this watcher, this observer is not doing anything, not controlling, not trying to get something, not getting upset or angry, not chasing any tortoise at all, with any moustache or without. It just stays sitting there, standing there, just being there, just watching. Not only do you gather the information which we call insight, but also you watch these things disappear, they fade away. The letting go, the fading away, the disappearing, which is what samatha means, what stillness means. You are still first of all, this watcher, and then the whole world becomes still in due course. The gradual process is you being still first and the things outside becoming still, which allows you to be more still, which allows the things outside to be more still, which allows you to be even more still, which allows the world just to stop and become still. You know the gradual path. First of all, the body gets still. Then hearing gets still, you can't hear anything. Thinking gets still somewhere along there. And start to see nimittas. And then mind becomes still when the nimitta stops moving. And when that nimitta starts moving, because the knower, the one looking, is still. That was a huge insight when that happened to me, because I didn't have such good instructions. Nimitta coming up, if that ever comes up, going all over the place, what should I do? Until I realized that the reason that nimitta is moving, because I, the watcher, was, well, not really the I, the self, but the watcher, that was moving. Why was it moving? Because I was trying to control it. When I try and do things, I move. So I realized that I had to be still for the nimitta to be still. It was me that was causing the problem. So when I became still, the watcher, the nimitta moved less and less and less. I had to be still first, and then the nimitta was still. And you understand, when these things happen, because these things become still, they start to fade away and disappear. The whole idea of sensory experience, it can only perceive things which change. When things are absolutely still, when they don't change for many, many minutes, you can't perceive them anymore. The senses turn off. That's called calming. And as they turn off, that's also called letting go. Letting go means they disappear. When you don't control, you're still. When you're still, the objects fade away, they vanish. From viraga, fading away, to nirodha, they cease. They disappear. Atagamana, they just go away. Disappear, vanish. It's a beautiful thing to understand. And when they start to vanish, you vanish as well. Because we measure ourselves by what we possess. When there's a self, there's things belonging to a self. When there's things belonging to a self, that's when there is a self. A lot of time you can define yourself not by some philosophical idea of what is a self, but what a self does, what it owns. I found a much better idea, much better rather path to get an understanding of this idea of non-self. you know, this idea of a non-self, a knower, a doer, a sort of, you know, cosmic consciousness, that was very difficult to really understand at first. But what I could understand is, what does this thing actually do? And what does it control? And I notice whatever it controls, that's what it thinks it possesses. This is the attachment. So when you read about attachments, sometimes what people thought were attachments, they just really got it so confusing. Attachment is always associated with wanting to control. When there's an ownership, you think that's yours, you want to possess it, control it, keep it, manipulate it, whatever it is, because you think that is yours. Same as the monks who've got different areas in this monastery, you know, they've got the storeroom, or they've got the recording, or whatever else is your job in this monastery. You want to control that and do it your way. It's my job. And someone comes along and says, I don't do it this way, I do it that way. Sometimes people get very upset. Simply because it's my job and I can do it my way. It's just possessing as well. It's great to see just how you can let things go. If you can't let things go, that shows you you own these things. You possess them. This is you're making yourself out of this. Which is why it's great to be able to accept criticism. You're a stupid fat pig. Why do people get upset? Because they think they own this body. They're not a stupid fat pig. It doesn't matter. I don't own this body. You can call it whatever you like. Amazing just how you can be so free when you don't own anything. When you don't own your body or your health or your mind, your achievements or non-achievements, whatever. You don't own these things. It makes life far more free. You just don't get upset. As they say, usually you become a small target. No one can hit you because you're not there. So the more you disappear, the more these things vanish, the more these things you understand these aren't yours, the easier they are to let go. And it's always the case when one starts in this monastery, it's so hard to let go of, you know, your idea of what other people think of you. I recall now that I said this to somebody recently, in my second range retreat, just towards the end of the range retreat, about this time, there's another Western monk with me. And we met together, and I don't know who suggested it, I think he suggested it, that we actually tell each other what we think of each other. You know, in a nice way. So I said, you know, having lived with this guy for almost 2.5 months, sort of what I thought of him. And he told me what he thought of me. And what was struck me, that what he thought of me was not what I thought he thought of me. Completely different. My idea of myself and his idea of myself were two different people. That was a wonderful little insight there, that all these ideas of who you think you are and what other people think of you are usually completely wrong. So, what do you think other people think of you? You know, the people you live with. You know, what do you think Ajahn Brahm thinks of you? I'll tell you, whatever you say, if you write that down, I'll look at it and I'll say quite honestly, that's not what I think of you. So, why do we maintain these ideas of ourselves? They're completely wrong, inaccurate, and a complete waste of time. If you had no idea of who you were, oh, what a wonderful world that would be. Criticism and praise just wouldn't stick with you anymore. It's wonderful being like that. So you can just be free. And also you wouldn't try so hard to please other people and get so upset, you know, when people don't appreciate you or whatever else upsets you. You leave all of that ridiculous stuff alone. As you learn that whatever you control is what you make yourself out of, and that is all delusion, stupidity, and the cause of a lot of suffering, little by little in monastic life, one just lets go more and more. What do you mean letting go more and more? I don't mean the possessions in your hut, the cardboard boxes and the books and the coffee makers and goodness knows what else you've got in that hut. I'm letting go of the real stuff, which is who you think you are. Yeah, they'll all go. And as it starts to disappear, you feel more and more free. And you can even let go of your body. You know, this body isn't mine. And because if you can really do that, it means when this body disappears in meditation, it just goes. And there's no resistance at all, no fear. It's amazing, just, it should be so obvious. All you who've done biology, got great educations in science, and seen bodies cut up, you should know, and seen your own body get old and decrepit. Yeah, you should know, this body is not mine, it's not me, nothing to do with me, it's just a vehicle I happen to be in for this lifetime. That should be just so obvious. However, it's just so superficial for most of you. If this body does get sick, you might get afraid. If you do get a lump, the nuns in the breast, you might get afraid. Men, you might get some lumps down between your legs and think it's testicular cancer or whatever, I don't know, prostate cancer. Would you get afraid? If you do, it shows that, you know, you still own this body, you think it's yours. It also means that when you start to meditate, you can't let it vanish. You can let it vanish so far, but you can't go the whole way and get into jhanas. So we have to understand this body, please understand it, it's nothing to do with us. It's not me, not mine. I don't own it. Gee, you know, you try and keep yourself healthy. I don't know how many people here are really healthy, but you know, it's tough to keep it healthy. And it's always get sick somewhere or other, and even if you really eat the right food and exercise, there's always something happens. So in the end, you understand, you do not own your body. It belongs to nature. Understand that. And you can test that when you've fully understood that, when you sit down, and you can just let it go. Hands disappear, legs disappear, back disappears, everything disappears. And the senses will go as well. I always say that sound is the last one to go of the senses, simply because that's the last alarm system for the protection of your body. Even at night time, if there's a danger there, you will hear it and wake up. Just this sense of sound is the most difficult because this is what we think is protecting us. You see even the kangaroos when they're sleeping. You see them laying down that they close their eyes but their ears are always moving around. For them too, sound is the last resort of protection for them. So it's hard to let go of the hearing only if we can fully let go of the body. And just, who cares about the body? See what happens to it. Someone else will look after it. Even you know this is a safe monastery, for goodness sake. The kangaroos don't eat you. It's not like in Thailand where a tiger might come up or a snake might crawl in your lap and bite you. This is so safe in this monastery. So why not just sit down and just completely allow the body to vanish? So you really don't have any attachment at all to this body. When the mind can let go, when the mind sort of detaches, the mind says, this is not me, not mine, not self, and the mind is still, then these things disappear. You can't keep that mind still if you think that what belongs to you is vanishing. You have to reach out, as a thief is stealing something from you. You have to reach out and stop them. When you realize you don't own this, you just let it vanish and let it go. What the hell? Not my business, nothing to do with me, it can go. And the job of monks like me is to tell you, it's bliss to let these things go. It's really worth it. If you want to have a good time, this is the place. Really a good time. And it's also, you get so much insight, understanding what happens when all these things go. So by the mind becoming still, and by you doing the letting go of the body, you find everything gets very peaceful and still. In the same way that when you're out there just eating or whatever, you're not really too concerned about stuffing up this body and just making it fat or strength, healthy or whatever, you're not concerned about this body. This body is there for a purpose to be used, for the holy life. And that's all it's here for. So you care for it, look after it, but you let it go. You don't indulge it. Same with sleepiness. Sometimes people think, oh, they need a certain amount of hours to sleep at night. Who said that? Is that written on your sort of butt somewhere? You must sleep 8 hours a night, or else, like you have on the computer, on the mini disc player, you must recharge for 8 hours at a time. It's not written on your butt or anywhere else. It's just your ideas. I don't believe in that. Sometimes you do need a lot of sleep. Sometimes you need little. So don't worry about it. If you make a mistake and you get up early at 1 o'clock and you start meditating, just do it. It shows that you're not afraid, that you don't attach to the body when you can do things like that. So you get tired. Big deal. Tiredness doesn't kill you. You get sleepy because you haven't slept enough. Big deal. That's one of the great things of our training under Ajahn Chah. Once a week we wouldn't sleep all night. So you got used to not sleeping and feeling that tiredness. It's just body, that's all. So you just were peaceful with it and just let it be and slept later on. You catch up all right, doesn't kill you. So be a bit more courageous, you know, with getting up when you just wake up in the morning, just jumping up. You know, the zippity-doo-dah, you can shout that if you want. Let's get all the kangaroos. Zippity-doo-dah, jump up and just meditate, see what happens. You know, some of the best times to meditate. I don't know what it is. People say just at dawn is the time when lots of people get enlightened. Some of you don't even give yourself a chance to get enlightened because you're still horizontal at dawn. So at least get up before dawn. So you're before the sun rather than after it. So what I'm actually saying there is that by not attaching to your body, you can do things like that. But the inability to do that shows you still really got some work to do. You really think that you are this physical frame. And it drags you around. And it will drag you around to your coffin, if you allow it. And it's not a good thing to do. So we understand this is not me, not mine, not a self, nothing to do with me. You're letting it go. It's not trying to put more badges on this body to take things off, to take away the own things you own. And this is what we meditate for, what we practice for. If someone's giving you a job, you just do it. I don't have my practice even. I don't try and control things. Somebody asked me, you know, just recently, why, I think it was the kids from Christchurch, why did you come to Perth? And it was only because as a young monk, I think after my first year, I made a resolution. I would never ask to go anywhere as a monk. I'd only be sent places. I'd be respond to invitations. So I was at Wat Nanachat for a long time until Ajahn Chah sent me to go to this monastery, and I stayed there until he asked me to go somewhere else. And after my 8th or 9th rains, I forget which, I was asked, I think Ajahn Sumedho asked me to come over to Perth. And no one's asked me to do anything else, which is why I'm still here. And that's the only reason. And I never said I don't want to go or I want to go. I never initiated anything. I remember actually when Ajahn Sumedho was starting the monastery in England, I actually quite wanted to go there, to be close to my family. But he never asked me, so I couldn't go. So it was always my resolution then. It's a wonderful way of letting go, of not trying to control your life. It's the same way if people ask me to do a job, I just do it. I wouldn't try and control anything. And that was why, even though I did a lot of service for other people, that was why I had good meditation. It wasn't the fact that I was doing things out of restlessness. I was doing things out of letting go. I was doing things because it was an act of renunciation. It was a service which was allowing my sense of self and controlling and manipulating and running my own affairs. It was allowing all that stuff to disappear. I was truly being free. And it's amazing that in this world people think freedom is having a will and having no limitations on your will. So you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. But as you meditate more and more, you start to see that this thing we call will is not a freedom at all, but is actually the prison. It's amazing that what we thought was freedom when we become close to enlightenment or enlightened, what we thought was freedom we recognize as a prison. And what was a prison for many people, you know, in a monastery, having to get up at a certain time, doing all these practices, what many people in the world think is a prison. Why on earth would you want to join a monastery and have all these rules to keep and do this and not be able to do what you want? You understand, this is freedom. And the reason is when you have following your will, trying to control things, it is the will which is controlling you. The will is not yours, it's not coming from you, it's not coming from, you know, your essential being. It's coming from outside, and it controls you. It is like the guard at Guantanamo Bay, telling the prisoners, get up, telling the prisoners, go to the toilet, telling the prisoners, eat, telling the prisoners, sit down. Always giving yourself orders. Meditate, watch the breath. You're meditating too much, you're too sloppy. You know, you can hear that will inside of yourself. And many people think that that's coming from yourself. And that's you. And you protect it. And you nurture it until the will becomes very strong. And you become a person, a being, a self. And you suffer as a result. Because the will is out of your control. How many of you try to watch the breath? Screw down your eyes. Clench your teeth. I'm going to watch the breath this time. I really am. I'm not going to let it go. I'd say I'm going to sit for 2 hours, or 3 hours, or 4 hours. How many of you get inspired and say, I'm going to get up at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning? It'd be great if you had that idea, but you won't be able to, because even if you will it, it won't happen. There's another way of doing it. But this will creates so much confusion for us. It creates restlessness and frustration and anger. Please use your understanding as much as you have now to know that your will is not a friend. It's not a cause of freedom, but it's a cause of tyranny. You're tyrannized by this thing you thought you owned. Understanding this much will make it easy for you to let go and not do anything, just to be able to sit there. To be able to help other people, because it's not your will. So like I said, I just let other people tell me what to do and where to go. I wouldn't choose it myself. I was really going against my will, what I wanted to do, what I thought was right, by repressing that will, by restraining it. It's amazing, isn't it? You just change the word repression, that must lead to bad psychological states, but restraining it, that must be good. Just the same thing, the same word, just by saying no to it. Understanding it. By just getting beyond it. And you find you can become very still, very quickly, very easily. And you find that whatever you did in the monastery becomes peaceful. Because you weren't resisting what you had to do. And it's tough sometimes being an abbot. Sometimes you have to sit up there and listen to all these silly people. And then you get back to your hut late, and as you're going past your hut, Ajahn Kampong wants to talk to you, and all you just want to go and do is crash out because you're just so tired. And so you just can't control your life. And then somebody rings up, and then something happens, or someone comes to talk to you. And just, as an abbot, you know, you think that you are the boss, you can control things. But, you know, from inside of being an abbot, you have even less control of your life than, say, the little novice at the end of the line. So you have power, but you can't use it. Weird thing. What happens is, the only way that you can survive is just let it be, let it go, don't worry about it, don't control it. Trying to control my day is impossible. So you just allow it to happen. By doing such things, you are stopping this will gaining power over your mind. So when you do meditate, you sit down, it's easy to let go. If I try to control my day and say, okay, 12:30, every lay visitor out. No one can actually come after 12:30. And all interviews, exactly 15 minutes. Not a minute more, not a minute less. And my breakfast, I will have porridge only up to a certain level. And I'll have 10 millimeters, not 11, not 9 millimeters of condensed milk. And if I try to control my life like that, what would happen is I would never be able to get any peace at all in my meditation. It's very hard being a senior monk, because you guys, you can actually choose your breakfast. I just have to look what's under the cup there and just see if I'm lucky today. That is good fun, I enjoy that. Who cares? So when that sort of thing happens, you're letting go much more. When you let go much more, it's actually easier to meditate. So afterwards, when I just go back and even like, you know, I've seen some of you, when you go on retreat, you have all this list, which you give to people what you want. Now, maybe it's a bit unfair because I've been here for such a long time and many of you have got to see what I like, but sometimes you get it wrong. But do I ever I give you a list of what I want? I never do that. Because I just want to let go of control. Because if you can let go of control, it makes it much easier to meditate. The more you control, even your, you know, when, what you tell people to put in your bowl. What are you doing there? You're actually exercising your will, encouraging it, strengthening it. So it's hard to let go when you meditate. If you just really let go of the external world, someone asks you to do a job, you know, it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks' time, you're going to have to prepare for the Katina. Ajahn Bamali, the work master, will ask you to do this and ask you to do that. I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. It's great. If he gives you a job you don't like doing, brilliant. Because that means that your will is going to be diminished. It's not what I want to do. Brilliant, thank you so much. So you should all ask Ajahn Bamali, please give me the job I don't want to do. Out of practice. And then you actually find it's easier to meditate. Because this will, this chetana, this force in the mind is being completely weakened. So when you meditate, it's not what I want to do. You just let go of the will. You'll become still. The will is the opposite of stillness. It's the agitator. It stirs up the mind. You do something. You want something. Letting go, stillness, the kindness accepts things as they are rather than trying to want them differently. It's brilliant when you understand how to meditate. You can do anything. You can be an abbot, you can be sort of the driver of the car, you can be the cook. Who cares? Because you're letting go in every moment, just doing what needs to be done. And that was the reason why is the attitude which I had as a young monk. So doing all this work for other people, but I was doing it with a sense of letting go, being kind to all these other people, doing the service. And I was not following, encouraging and strengthening my will, which meant I was letting go of a sense of self. So when it came down to the times, I'd always have plenty of time to meditate. The evenings, the mornings, the afternoons. Just our lifestyle means we, you know, we don't work all that much. We have time. So when it was time, it's very easy to let go of the will. To not think, what should I do next? And how should I meditate? What should I watch? And how many of you have asked me during interview times, I get to this stage, then what should I do? It should be, I always give the same answer, nothing. Stop this will. Be still. Stop trying to control your meditation. Sit down and allow it to happen. Even today I told the visitors, you know, the story of the cup. If you hold the cup, it never, the water inside, a cup of tea inside, will never be still. You let go, you put the cup down, And when you put the cup down, it always happens, the water, in this case the tea, moved more as soon as you put it down because you're disturbing it a little bit. But when you put it down, you let go of it, you're not holding it, controlling it, grasping it, attaching to it. It becomes still all by itself. It's a wonderful simile because that's exactly what happens with the mind. You let go of the will when you meditate. It means you're putting your mind down, you're putting the breath down, you're putting everything down. You're not holding it. And it becomes still. So a wonderful process to see. You sit there, you're doing absolutely nothing. You're just watching. You are still. The mind is the forerunner of all things. You are still, you're just watching. And the mind gets stiller and stiller and stiller. But you've got to be careful because sometimes this will gets involved and wants to change it. Because you've been encouraging the will all throughout your day. Making your own schedule, getting your own way, doing it your way. No wonder you can't let go when you meditate. So it's great to be able to have core what? Monastic rules. It means you just do it that way. You don't have to think. You can let go of the will. The will becomes subdued by the monastic rule. Because it doesn't have any freedom to express itself. Sometimes, you know, you try. Remember this nun, well, it's this American nun. She came up to confess. She said that she was in her hut in Wat Pa Phong. She closed all the windows so no one could see her doing this act of rebellion, which was drinking her water standing up. Because in Thailand, you're supposed to squat down every time you drink anything. It was a silly, silly thing to do, but you know, she was independent. She wanted to do it her way. And you knew from what she said, that was, for a Westerner, for a lay person, that was an act of rebellion. Good on you. You're not going to allow other people to tell you what to do. But in Dharma, according to the way of liberation, that just stops you getting closer to liberation. You're encouraging this will. You're indulging in it. Which means that the will gets stronger. So when the time does come to meditate and stop, you just can't do it. It's just the will always gets involved. It interferes. And it stops. So the more you can free yourself and let go of this idea of doing, coming from the sense of self, from the delusion you think this is your inalienable right to control things, especially certain areas of your life. If that's what you really think, then you're going to have a hard time meditating, and you will have no peace. Chaitanya always leads to suffering. Eventually, it's called frustration. It doesn't go the way I want it to go. Other people are just really stupid. Now, they should know better. Of course they shouldn't know better. They just, you know, each one of you been in this monastery long enough to know there will always be dirty spoons left somewhere. There will always be tools left out going rusty. There will always be things gone wrong. That's just life. We try and do it the best way, but we can't control it. So understanding this, we understand that our job of our mind is actually to let go of our body, not to control it. Understand it's not ours, it's non-self, it's nothing to do with us. Letting go of our will, it's not me, it's nothing to do with me. And in fact it's my enemy, not my friend. So I'm going to try and do less and serve more, be more selfless. Not trying to be an individual and to be different than other people, but try and almost disappear in a monastery. Even try and dress exactly the same as others, not different. Not to be individual, but to vanish, for the self to go. One of the reasons, you can tell this to the visitors here, especially the children, why is it that monks always wear the same robes? Why can't we design our own robes and have some individual hairstyles? It's because we're supposed to disappear. When we disappear, we get closer to non-self. When we get closer to non-self, it's easier to meditate. And that whole idea, you know, about do you need jhanas to get enlightened? To me, it is a ridiculous statement. Because jhanas are stages on the path, stages of letting go. What is enlightenment anyway? Enlightenment is when you let go of things, when you're free. If you let go of things, of course you can let go of the body whenever you want. You can free yourself from the five senses, which means you get jhanas. Of course it happens. Has to. There's no barrier, nothing stopping you from getting into these deep states of meditation when you've let go of things. That's why, if anything, jhana should be the test of whether you've got these stages of enlightenment or not. Have you got these jhanas? Then you kind of got to that stage. You can't be an anagami or an arahat. No way. Because you can't let go that much. It means you've still got attachments. You've still got fetters. That's why you can't be free. So it's just a test. I've often said that, you know, people can say they're enlightened and they can have all these amazing Dharma talks and these very profound sayings, but that doesn't cut any ice with me. Cut the mustard. I always get this wrong. Is it cut the mustard or cut the ice? Who cares? Anyway, it doesn't make any sense to me. But when a person can be still, and that makes sense, they've got insight if they can be still. So the measure of insight of wisdom is your ability to be still. To the ability to let go. Not to be able to say profound things or write great books. So if you understand that, you understand that all these things are just part of the path. So, range retreat, non-range retreat. You've got duties to perform in the kitchen or you're just on retreat with nothing to do. You've got to answer the phone or you've got to sweep the paths. Doesn't matter. It's how you're doing all of that, what your attitude is, whether you are increasing your attachment to your body or you're decreasing it, whether you're increasing your thinking or decreasing it, whether you're increasing your association with your will or whether you're letting it all go. That determines your success. It's good to do retreats. But it's also good to do service. But it's even better to do both the right way with this beautiful attitude. When you do that, not only do you get enlightened, not only do you get jhanas, you do it through seeing non-self. No one in here. Not my body. Not my will. Not my thinking. Not my jhanas. Not my insight. Not my time, nothing. So see if you can do that. Last 2 weeks, who knows what might happen. Just stop trying. Thank you.
Arahaṁ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṁ Bhagavantaṁ Abhivādin Suvākato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammānasaṁ Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṁ Namāmi.